Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Dr. Catherine Crofts. Hi Catherine, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I put the emphasis on doctor because Catherine has just passed her PhD. How cool is that? Why don't you tell us about it?
Oh, thanks. I've just spent the last 3 years investigating high levels of insulin, hyperinsulinemia and its effects on metabolic disease, and trying to work out the best way of diagnosing hyperinsulinemia. I've been so lucky to work with a brilliant group of people, including Professor Grant Schofield, Dr. Karen Zinn, and was really, really lucky to get in touch with Dr. Joseph Kraft from Chicago. And he is 96 in August, and he collected a database back in the 1970s that just sort of really did show the patterns that insulin produced in the bloodstream after a glucose load, and how this is probably one of the earliest diagnostic tools for hyperinsulinemia. And it's really funny now that 40 years later, his work's just starting to be recognized because we're at the stage where we can actually look at hyperinsulinemia and maybe how it sort of just comes into just so many different metabolic diseases, from type 2 diabetes to cancer to heart disease, but also to dementia.
And that was going to be our subject for today, which I think is fascinating. It's a topic I know almost nothing about. And maybe a good introduction for both me and the people listening would be for you to talk about your time working on the ward.
A few years ago, after I'd finished my master's thesis, I wanted to do my PhD, but I had my husband told me that I had to get a scholarship to be able to do my PhD full time. That meant that I had to go back to work. And I'm a pharmacist, and I'd spent, you know, 15 years at this point working in community pharmacy, but I'd outgrown community pharmacy. I was now wanting to really get my teeth into a more academic and cognitive side of pharmacy. And there was an opening at one of the local hospitals for an older adult pharmacist for the older adult mental health service. And I'd had a lot of experience with older adult pharmacy. I didn't know much about mental health, but they were quite happy to take on as a chance. And I spent 2.5 years working with older adult mental health. Now, while that meant that we dealt with the normal mental health conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar disease, I spent a lot of time dealing with the different dementias and the challenges that are associated with people all the way through their dementia journey and their families. And it really was a case of there was very little we could do for many of these people. And it was when I started getting in, looking into the insulin side of things. So I left that job, and I had a fantastic time there with VitaMatter. I really did. I only left that job to go and do my PhD. And there was a little bit of soul searching because I was enjoying the mental health journey so much as to whether I should go and do the PhD or stay where I was. I'm pleased I did the PhD. But when I was looking through, and I was starting to look through all of the metabolic diseases that were associated with hyperinsulinemia, the dementias started jumping out as well. And it's a case of, well, hang on a second. We keep saying there's nothing we can do, but they're describing Alzheimer's disease as type 3 diabetes. They're saying, you know, that Alzheimer's dementia is very, very much a disease of diabetes and insulin and glucose. Now, we talk about the dementias. Most people think about dementia as being Alzheimer's disease, but there's about 4 main classes of dementia. We've got the Alzheimer's disease, which is associated with these sort of protein tangles within the brain. Then you've got vascular dementia, which is sort of associated with the blood vessels. People might have had lots of mini strokes, or the blood vessels are getting shrunk and damaged with inside the brain. And because the blood vessels get blocked and just stop working, bits of the brain die around them. Then you've also sort of got Lewy body dementia, which is another type of protein deposit, the Lewy bodies that are slightly different to the amyloid plaques that you find with Alzheimer's. But these diseases never happen in isolation. Most people will have a mixed dementia. One of my consultants, one of the things that he always did with anybody who was admitted onto the ward was we got a CT scan of the brain, a specialized X-ray of the brain. And we always looked at everybody's brain scan. And I can't tell you much beyond that hole's bigger than it should be. The brain's smaller than it should be, and it's a lot grainier than it should be. You can probably tell the difference between a healthy brain and an unhealthy brain. And most people had mixed symptoms on the CT scan. It wasn't just Alzheimer's disease. It may be Alzheimer's predominant, but there's a lot of vascular changes as well, or vice versa. So when we talk about dementia, there's lots of things happening with the brain, and many of them come back to insulin.
And then tell me about how these people interact with the world. How would you describe their symptoms? What are their problems?
Very much depends on which stage that they've been diagnosed at when they came into the ward, or where in the brain things happened. Now, when I say where in the brain, my sort of mentioning, you ended up with holes in the wrong place or grainy bits where they shouldn't be. Depending on where it is in the brain, can end up with different things happening. Anything happening around the Niagara strata or something, you end up with a lot more movement challenges, and you end up with some more of the physical disorders. But if you get some of the other changes happening in the front part of the brain, the frontal temporal system, action and consequence kind of get missed, or the consequences for an action just get missed. And these people, you talk to them, and they seem to have a completely normal conversation and trying to work out, right, why is this person here? And then they try and do something, well, there's just no thought, they just can't put the consequence to the action, like banging their way through a locked door to try and get to the food that's on the other side of it. You know, it's the door is locked, but that's not going to stop them.
Oh, because, I see.
Right. I can see really why they took the car keys off you. If you were driving, you might be able to physically drive your car down the road, but you're not going to recognize that a child has just stepped out or is about to step out, and you're just going to bowl straight through. That's why you bowl through that stop sign.
So is simulator the right word to use? Like I've heard Dr. Kirk Parsley talk about a simulator, and I believe that analogy or metaphor, it came originally from Robert Sapolsky. And just after he said that to me, I thought, wow, that's such a perfect metaphor. And the example that I had was my two-year-old daughter putting her teeth on my finger and then looking at me. And you could see like the wheels turning, like I could clamp down pretty hard right now and really hurt you. And she didn't do it. And it was that simulator, that kind of moving through like, okay, so what's going to happen after that? And then after that, and after that, and what are the consequences going to be? So is that the part that's broken in these people?
In a lot of people with frontal temporal dementia, yeah. It's a case of they're not going to associate. It's almost coming back to the two-year-old type thing for some of these people. It's a case of, I'm going to bite down on this. And your two-year-old's going, but if I did that, these are going to be the consequences.
Right.
For people, you know, that bit's missing. They just don't see the consequences. But for other people with Alzheimer's, they might lose their words. They might call something by the wrong name, or they just might not remember the name for it. They might have difficulty expressing themselves. They might lose their memories. And that can be really, really frustrating for a lot of people. What can be really more frustrating for them is they know it's they know that they can't do some of these things, but they don't know why they can't do it, and they always used to be able to do it. And that can be really, and that frustration can manifest itself in different ways, behavioral issues, anger issues. People might go for a walk because they've always gone for a walk, but then they forget where they live. Or they don't they're looking for the home that they lived in 20 years ago. They're looking for where they were 20 years ago, and they just don't recognize where they are. So it's a scary world for a lot of these people, because some of them know what's happening, some of them don't. And so each person, when we were working with them, it was very, very individualized. We're constantly thinking, how can we make this person's journey better? We know there's no cure, but is there anything we can do to slow the progression of their disease state? Is there anything that we can do to improve their behaviors, help reorientate them, put strategies in place that they can be managed? Because these people all have families. You know, it was very rare for us to have somebody who didn't have family, and some of these family members would visit every day and would want to know how they're going to take their loved one home again. but how they were going to manage with that person at home again. You know, that can actually sort of be really quite difficult when you're trying to get this person home, but you're trying to keep them safe. You're trying to keep the family members safe. You're trying to reduce burden on the family members by doing everything that you can just to try and keep a family together.
And then what do you think the prevalence of this disease is? So let's say Alzheimer's specifically, is this a rare and uncommon disease, or is it?
No, it's not. And the prevalence is only getting higher. It used to be considered to be an older person's disease, but the scary thing is a lot of people over the age of 60 are starting to get noticeable cognitive changes. I think it was the Whitehall study when they're saying they can start noticing changes in some people from the age of 48. Now, some people, sort of academics especially, they've got a high degree of cognitive reserve. So maybe you need to have a lot of change before you start noticing in these people. But for other people, they may not have such a high degree of cognitive reserve, and so changes and problems might be detected earlier. You know, it's when you talk to an academic who's in their mid-90s, you know, it's a case of, sometimes it's a case of, I mean, it's not just Dr. Kraft, there's a lot of people that I work with on the ward as well. It's, you can tell that you've lost, there's a good chance that they've lost their top end, but my God, what's still there is just fantastic. And, you know, there's this, you know, they're still extremely functional in the scheme of things, but they probably have lost their top end. But for other people, they may not have quite so much reserve to lose. And that's a problem for a lot of people.
And I wonder how many people are under or not diagnosed at all, right? Like, so how long has this situation been in the making? And it's only when it gets to a certain level or a certain point that you actually get the diagnosis. And so the disease may be underdiagnosed.
Very much so.
Well, I'm really interested to hear about your hypothesis of type 3 diabetes, because I spent a little bit of time on Wikipedia this afternoon, and they actually introduced a number of hypotheses, and they talk about genetics, and they talk about the ApoE gene, which is quite interesting, and then they talk about the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, and they talk about amyloid plaques, and they talk about this tau protein, which is very interesting, and they even talk about an infection with spirochetes, but I can't find any mention of insulin or type 3 diabetes or anything.
There's a few things going on that people just, we don't know enough about. Right, so we've got the etiology, but then we've also got sort of ongoing issues. Now, one of the things is that we know that high levels of insulin is involved with a couple of different things, one of which is with the protein bindings and the tau proteins. People don't really know enough of what's going on with that at this point in time, but there's also an issue with, so we know we've got a changed regulation of the beta amyloid plaques and the tau proteins. We don't really know the implications with that, because one of the things is that it's just not really known at the moment is with the beta amyloid plaques, as to whether they, there's two theories out there as to whether they're protective for Alzheimer's disease or damaging in Alzheimer's disease. And one of the latest theories is that it's the particle size of the clumps. If you've got really small clumps of beta amyloid, it might be protective. And very large clumps of beta amyloid, it might be protective. But the medium-sized clumps might be damaging. All we know at this point in time is there's some potential mechanisms that we just don't know enough about. But also we've got changes with synaptic plasticity with another dysregulated system called PSA-NCAM. And it's a polycyclic acid. It's for neural cell adhesions. And we don't really know enough about that, but we do know that cell plasticity in the brain is really important for what's called neuroplasticity. And if one bit of the brain dies, a neuroplastic brain will sort of build connections around that and keep going. So while we've got the links for mechanisms, we don't understand enough about insulin and the mechanisms yet, except hyperinsulinemia seems to be associated with these problems. But we most certainly know that hyperinsulinemia is associated with vascular changes and with type 2 diabetes. And so given that type 2 diabetes is one of the biggest risk factors for developing Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, then it's something that has to be explored. But when you start looking at vascular changes within the brain, which is really, really key with all of the dementias. This is really where insulin and changes in the brain really start coming through. Because the brain is a highly, highly, highly vascularized organ. Even at rest, the brain uses 20% of your fuel supply. And to get that, all that fuel, all that oxygen, and whatever fuel it's using to get to the brain, it relies on a really, really important vascular system. Now, I'll come back to fuel sources shortly. We've got several things that are happening then with the brain and the vascular system and insulin. Because what we know is when you've got high levels of insulin, it changes a lot of things in the capillaries. You end up with endothelial microdamage. You get a lot of vasoconstriction. The nitric acid doesn't work quite so well. And you sort of get changes to capillary permeability and microaneurysms forming. So one of the things that insulin does is it prevents a process called fibrinolysis, which is the breaking down of blood clots. So a high level of insulin prevents micro blood clots from being broken down. Now those things will stick in the brain, cause little bits of the brain to die. They'll clog all of the blood vessels in the brain because they're very, very fine blood vessels. They'll start getting blocked up. And that's just insulin doing that. But then you've got the other challenges that happens when you've got high levels of insulin. Insulin is elevated, usually in response to increased glucose in the bloodstream. You know, it's trying to get that glucose down. So we may have elevated insulin, but we might not see that glucose change in the blood because the insulin's working there in background. But the glucose has been there and it's also doing stuff in background. Now, one of the things that glucose does is it increases the thickness of the blood, essentially. It causes increased blood coagulability. It makes the blood clot a little bit easier. So in those really, really fine blood vessels, you've got thicker blood that when it clots, your clots aren't going to be broken down quite so easily. Now, the brain is also fascinating with the way it takes up glucose. Now, I get all my blood transporters, my glucose transporters a little bit mixed up. But the brain relies on what we call GLUT1. And the GLUT1 transporter is there in most cells around the body because it's your basal respiration. And it takes up glucose. Now, I can't find out easily if it's an active transport system that can slow things down, or it's very much reliant on the concentration of glucose in the blood. You've got high concentration of glucose in the blood, then it just encourages more glucose to be taken up into the brain. Other bits of your body, like your liver, work on that, whereas your muscles and things, it's all insulin dependent. You know, it relies on insulin to get the glucose into a lot of the muscle cells and things. But so it's, you know, it's possible that, you know, the high level of insulin, because of the high level of glucose, just sort of says that we've got so much glucose going into the brain. But then several things happen within the brain. Is if you've got cells that are being overfed, you know, they've been forced to take up glucose because there's too much of it in the bloodstream, we end up with an overfeeding syndrome, and we end up with a lot of oxidative stress in the cells, and that actually causes the cells to die. And it may be implicated with some of the inflammation that's associated with the development of these beta amyloid plaques. And they think that the development of these medium-sized damaging plaques might be due to systemic inflammation. So while it's hard to say at this point whether the hyperinsulinemia is a direct contributor to the Alzheimer's or not, with what's happening with the tau plaques and the beta amyloid tangles and things, certainly not helping. Then you've got the other challenges with what happens within the brain. The insulin within the brain does several things, and one of the things they actually think it might be doing is doing with cell signaling. Now, you mentioned the hormone, a neurotransmitter earlier called acetylcholine, and they know that with Alzheimer's, acetylcholine is one of the key transmitters for neurosignaling within the brain. And a lot of the drugs that they give people is all to do with increasing levels of acetylcholine in the brain to try and help with the signaling better. But insulin's also involved with the signaling, but they just haven't really sort of got their heads around what or how, because the brain actually will make its own insulin. We don't know why yet, but the brain actually It's not just the pancreas within the body that makes insulin. The brain does it as well. And they're thinking that, well, maybe this is needed for more than glucose regulation. Maybe it's needed for signaling. We just don't know enough yet. But what we do know is that glucose flux and fuel flux within the brain, and there's now sort of, so for Alzheimer's type dementia, we've got issues where the insulin may be contributing, and the inflammation and things may be contributing to the plaques that are implicated with Alzheimer's disease. But then you've got vascular dementia, which is high levels of insulin causes vascular disease around the body. There's no question about that. So vascular dementia is very much a disease of high insulin. Most people do not have one of these diseases in isolation. Most people will have a mixed. So there'll be a mixed progression of Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. It's called mixed dementia. And that would be probably about 75% of the people with a dementia. It will be a mixed type, and it may even be higher than that. So trying to tease out insulin with Alzheimer's or insulin with vascular, when most people are dealing with mixed, it's going to be, we're talking a lot more sort of test tube type experiments rather than the real people type experiments to really work out what's going on there. So we have to sort of work with the epidemiological studies that go Alzheimer's type 3 dementia, because if you've got type 2 diabetes, sorry, Alzheimer's is type 3 diabetes, because if you've got type 2 diabetes, major risk factor for developing dementia. But then you've got the flip side of the coin, and it's looking at how people are managed after that. And what happens in the brain of somebody with Alzheimer's or vascular dementia, we're just from this point on, I'm just going to talk about it as being dementia, is fuel flux becomes critical. Now, what I mean by fuel flux is when somebody eats a typical carb-laden meal, for the next, sort of 2 hours, you'll get a peak and you'll get a rise in blood glucose, and blood glucose will hit a peak and then blood glucose will drop. And you'll sort of bottom out and you start feeling hungry again. Now, what they believe happens is that people with dementia can end up with brain challenges at both the top end of fuel flux, when there's lots and lots of fuel in the brain, especially glucose, and at the bottom end of the spectrum when they're hungry and you've got low fuel flux. I mean, if you think about the term hangry, right, you're so angry because you're hungry. Part of that is because the brain, as I said, needs so much energy. It needs a constant supply of fuel. And all of the symptoms that you get with a hypoglycemic episode come from the brain being hungry. It's saying, I'm starting to starve here, guys. We need to start feeding me again. That's when you get the confusion. You can't think properly. You get the irritability. And you may end up with making some poor decisions when you're hungry. Now, if you take that concept and put it into a challenged brain, a brain that's already not thinking clearly in the best of days, and you take away some of the glucose, you've got brain cells that are struggling to maintain normal thinking, take away some fuel, they're even more challenged at this point. So you have to start wondering if some of the behavior changes that you see when you have somebody who has an almost rapid behavior change, sometimes food does make a difference. And maybe that's getting a little bit of glucose back into the cell. Now, the other problem that you have is when you're at the peak end of fuel flux and you've got lots and lots of fuel, glucose especially, in your bloodstream. Once that happens, it's a little bit toxic to the brain cell because of that overfeeding, inflammation, and it can also encourage the production of something called glutamate from glutamine. Now, glutamine is an amino acid. It's used in the brain to make several different neurotransmitters. Glutamate can be a little bit toxic to the brain. And it's another entity that is targeted with drug treatment for Alzheimer's disease to reduce glutamate. The flip side of the coin is that when everything's going nicely with fuel flux in the brain, you're in a nice intermediate stage and you've got even fuel within the brain, you've got GABA being produced from glutamine. Now, GABA is a calming hormone. It's If you give somebody a benzodiazepine, a chill pill, an anti-anxiety, it increases the amount of GABA that's in the brain, or it works on the GABA receptors. So you can induce a state of calm in somebody with the, or at least reduce agitation, if you've got the right amount of fuel going into the brain. Now, they've done this study with both. They looked at a high infusion of insulin into people with Alzheimer's disease and maintaining the blood glucose steady, and found that they got an improvement in symptoms. But they did the same thing, and they put people on a ketogenic diet, and they also found an improvement in a very similar stage of symptoms, and they believe that's due to fuel flux. So if you've got somebody who's on a, you know, a carb-laden system, their energy supply is going up, down, up, down, up, down. Poor brain is sort of going toxic, hungry, and it maybe if we can sort of change the way the brain is being fueled, then maybe that will have some implications for management of people with different dementias. But also, if you're not having the oxidative stress on the brain, will that slow the progression of some of the disease states?
This is really interesting. So you're saying that a ketogenic diet may be a useful therapy for dementias?
Yeah.
And has anyone done any work on this? Has anyone looked at it or tried it? Or
There are some studies in the literature. It does look like it has been tried. It's definitely a viable option. But there are some real practical difficulties with its implementation. I mean, as I said earlier, you have people in a state of dementia where it's being recognised that they've got dementia, but often it's being recognised because they've become, I don't know, fixed in their ways. They're behaving really, really irrationally. Now, for these people, if you suddenly go, right, I know you really love your beer, your pasta, your bread and your potatoes and your sugar, and we're now going to take that all away from you, that's going to be a major problem. That's really going to...
It's just not going to work, right? I mean, you could almost hear the penny drop as I realised what you were saying, you know, that, you know, some people would argue that a ketogenic diet is difficult to implement or difficult to adhere to, or they might even say it's a hideous diet. I've heard that said before as well, because it's just so much fat and it's all unpalatable. But those things can typically be overcome by the types of people that listen to this podcast, namely practitioners and athletes. But yeah, if you're taking someone who's got some kind of dementia, you know, can you, is this even an option?
Is it viable? I don't know. I said, all I know is that people can sort of really have a behavior outburst. I've had patients have a major behavior outburst when you tell them they can't go outside into the garden because it's raining, when you try and take their cell phone off them, you try and tell them they're changing their diet. Now, it can work if they're in a institution where they're being managed by all the nursing staff and everything else. But for somebody who's just been diagnosed because their spouse is going, they're really irritable and I change the slightest thing in the house and it gets a temper outburst, I'm concerned that something's happened. You try changing a diet, that may not be possible. At the same time, though, you get people coming through to the early memory clinic where you've got the patient going, I want to be checked out. I think there's some changes happening. And so I want my memory checked. Am I in the early stages of Alzheimer's? Okay, right, I am. What can I do now? And a lot of these people are looking to make lifestyle changes. Those are the people are the ones who would probably get a lot of benefit. It's not to say that people with, you know, moderate disease state where you're not going to be able to make a full change to the diet, but really getting these people onto low glycemic index foods would make quite a bit of difference. If you can reduce some of that glucose fuel flux, you know, and take away a lot of the high GI foods, you possibly will make some difference. But for people at the early stage of the journey, when they still understand action consequence, you can talk to them then about changing the diet and see if it works, you know, and for those people, it might really be viable.
And then what would happen if you were to try and sneak in, say, some of the ketogenic foods like MCT oil or ketone esters or salts, or maybe even just coconut oil? Could those things help, do you think?
I don't know, possibly. I mean, the key thing is looking at fuel flux. Now, in the ketone esters might be a possibility, but you'd have to be really careful because I don't know what happens if you suddenly put ketones into a system that's glucose laden. are you still going to end up with overfeeding? Because the mitochondria doesn't really care where it's getting its energy from to a degree. It just has to deal with it. And so what's going to happen there? My biochemistry is a little bit weak at that point. But if you've also, though, got somebody who's been running on a carb-based system for so long, can they convert the fatty acids to ketones? Because fatty acids do not cross the blood-brain barrier. Only ketone bodies do. So you've got to get the ketones into the brain for the brain to use them as fuel. And the brain will quite happily use ketones as fuel. Oh, that's one of the things that just makes me cross when you see that the brain has to run on this amount of glucose a day and it can't run on ketones. It's a case of no, fatty acids will not cross the blood-brain barrier. Ketones will. But if you've got a liver that's never been asked really to convert fatty acids to ketones for so long, you don't know how long it's going to take to get that up to running or if it can get it up to running. So we just don't know enough about this yet. Would it hurt to try? No, not in the slightest. Okay, as long as you're being moderate about it and just don't suddenly start doing this sort of thing. You know, it also wouldn't hurt to try and reduce some of the sugars that are in people's diets. Try and switch out some of the sweet fruits for berries or sweet vegetables like bell peppers or capsicum. You know, reducing some of the really sweet treats. I mean, it's afternoon tea on the ward and where I was working was always a what we call in New Zealand a ginger kiss, but it was cake with some buttercream, you know, a small cake with some buttercream on the middle of it. Looking back at it now, I'm just sort of going, oh, that was probably the worst thing in the world for these people to have. Maybe they could have had some cheese and crackers instead of something sweet. The crackers would have at least have been in a step in the right direction.
Right. So these people, they're being fed a diet on a ward. Is it not then quite easy to manipulate it?
You'd like to think. Have you ever tried to change a hospital ward's diet?
I mean, they must make the decisions. Where do they get the diet from in the first place? Where does it come from?
To be honest, I don't know. I mean, we've got the dietitian on the ward who would be making a lot of changes, but they were being fed, for most people, they didn't need any special dietary requirements. So it was the standard hospital food. But also our occupational therapists would often have people making pikelets and things in the kitchen. And it was trying to give a lot of the people a sense of normality. You know, pikelets are pikelets, you know, sort of mini, thick mini pancakes, hot cake type things. So it's a case of, one, is it about can they be safe in the kitchen? But two, it's a really good activity for them to do that's sort of keeping the brain and body engaged in normal day-to-day activities. But these things will be slow to change. So, you know, some of the staff that I have worked with since are sort of going, maybe we should rethink that, but I haven't been back for a few years to see if anything has changed.
And so tell me more about the role of using your brain then. Is it a case, is it just as simple to understand as use it or lose it? And that's why they recommend that you should do puzzles and Sudoku and, you know, other things like that that would engage your brain and maybe that can help with the onset of dementia.
Possibly. They don't know enough about it, but they're sort of going, maybe it's a use it or lose it, but maybe the people who aren't using it because they're losing it,
right.
not because of a lack of trying. But one of the things, you know, sort of I come back to, it's that thing called neuroplasticity. It's having cells that can, you know, so many of the neurons in the brain, they talk to so many other neurons to get a cohesive message going through. Now, if a little bit of the brain has died, the neurons that used to talk to that bit of the brain are going, oh, can't talk to that bit of the brain anymore. Right, where should I be sending this message? And they can develop new connections. And this is that thing called neuroplasticity. The brain will create new connections around something where something has died. I mean, if you think about a person who's had a minor stroke, a bit of a brain's died, they lose the ability to smile, they lose the ability to use their hands in certain ways, they lose their ability to sort of walk, to talk. But for some of these people, with probably a great deal of luck in many cases, but if they've got a neuroplastic brain and they get the right assistance from the occupational therapist, the physiotherapist and everybody else, they can regain their ability to do a lot of these things. And that's the brain making new connections. That's the neuroplasticity in place.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. So is that the same process then when you see someone that's had a traumatic brain injury? They, you know, maybe they've crashed their bike or been in a car accident or something like that, and they lose some of their brain function. Is it that same process then that they're almost relearning to do things again like a child?
Yes, it is. It's that brain having to make the new connections. Well, at least to the best of my understanding, it's the brain making new connections. Because once your bit of the brain has died, it's not coming back. But there's a lot of reserve in the brain, and maybe you can retrain other bits to do the same job.
And one last kind of weird, slightly maybe technical question that you won't want to talk about, but I've just had a thought. So we know that people who are APOE4 carriers, they might not do well on a high-fat diet. And APOE is also implicated in Alzheimer's. Are we running into a problem here where you can't really put these people onto a high-fat diet because of this gene that may be implicated in the disease in the first place?
There's so much that we don't know about Alzheimer's. We don't know why it happens. It's a multimodal system. So for some people, high glucose, yet definitely a problem. We get those people onto, you know, a lower glucose system. I mean, the way I look at it is, it's not an either or system. The body is designed to run on two engines. The mitochondria within the cell doesn't mind if it's getting its energy from glucose. It doesn't mind if it's getting its energy from ketone bodies. And it can use a few other bits and pieces there in between to produce ATP. All the cell cares about is that it's getting a steady supply of ATP to create energy, very, very simplistically. What we have to do is manage the fuel that's going into the mitochondria so that we're not causing overfeeding, which causes many of the other problems, including insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and then the body just does not do well on glucose. So I would say for people who have got the APOE gene, the earlier you can identify them, the better, because then you can work out where they fit in the hyperinsulinemia stakes and how much carbohydrate restriction you need to put in place to keep their insulin levels down to a healthy balance. It's all about finding your healthy balance. Now, for a lot of people with APOE, if you find it early, you may not need to do too much in the way of carbohydrate restriction to prevent the other metabolic changes that lead you towards type 2 diabetes and the risk that carries for Alzheimer's disease. And that way you're going to be able to keep these people on a whole food, low GI diet is going to be higher in carbohydrates and lower in the fats that they don't want to take on board because of that gene system. We've spent so many years in a one diet fits all, which in reality is one diet fits none system, that we forget that we need to be tailoring diets to suit the individual, not forcing the individual to fit into a dietary system. So does that sort of go a long way to answering your question?
Yeah, it does. So I was going to twist your arm and ask you, you know, kind of as a takeaway message for people who maybe are caregivers or know somebody with some type of dementia or specifically Alzheimer's, you know, with the preface that, you know, this is not medical advice. You know, we can't do that over the internet. Just some things, some take home points that people can think about what you've learned. And I think you've started with that. So start thinking about the glycemic load of the diet. But is there anything else?
Well, as I said, I'm a pharmacist. I've been practicing in the community for the better part of 20 years. My take home diet message is just about anybody. I mean, I had one of my pharmacy students look at me at the end of a very busy 6-hour period and go, "You don't like sugar much, do you?" I would say about every second person got told, take away added sugars from your diet and eat more non-starchy vegetables. So I'm really pushing for a whole food diet where possible. Limit your added sugars. And I think that's a message that is everybody should take on board. Limit your added sugars, and that's honey, that's your agave, that's your coconut sugar, I'd say your date sugars. You know, reduce your sugar load, especially sugars from fruit juice, especially from added sugars. It doesn't matter if they're from a healthy source or not, the body can't deal with it. Limit your sugar intake. Make the largest part of your diet non-starchy vegetables. Right? From there, that's possibly where you need to be talking to your healthcare provider or a dietitian as to what's going to work best for your individual makeup. But even people with Alzheimer's disease who are going to be reluctant to change, if you can reduce carbohydrates, the sugary sources, sources of sugar, not just sources that you pour
in. They do happen a lot, but yeah, I understand what you're saying.
But if you can reduce the sugar intake and increase the vegetable intake, that might be a very good start. From there, we need to individualize diets.
No, that's been great.
But also, if you're at the early stages and you're thinking, well, maybe, yeah, definitely do your own homework, talk to people. Maybe a carbohydrate restricted diet is best for you, but I'm going to say do your own homework on that and talk to your healthcare provider, especially if you're in the early stages of, you've got early memory loss and even the early cognitive changes.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. And for everybody listening, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then it's almost a continuation of the discussion of insulin, because we're going to talk about the CRAFT test, which I have done, that measures insulin in response to a glucose load over time rather than just a static fasting measure. And Catherine is going to talk about why a fasting insulin measurement is almost useless and why you need to see the dynamic response. And that will be part of the Keto Summit that's coming up this autumn. So if you look in the show notes for this episode, I'll have a link to the Keto Summit that you can sign up for. And I think I've already mentioned the list of names on the summit. It's really quite phenomenal. And I've really been enjoying these interviews. So I'm hoping that you'll sign up and get access to that, because it's some really great content. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you. And I think it's so interesting to hear a pharmacist talk about food like that. When you get to the end, you'd expect a pharmacist to have some pharmacological solutions to these problems that you're discussing. But you didn't really mention, in fact, you didn't mention a drug the whole episode, which is quite extraordinary.
Well, I think my job, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed talking to you about this. But I think my job is to get people off the pills, not to start them on it. And I'm looking forward to coming back and talking to you for your Keto Summit as well.
Awesome. Thank you very much.